listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Guitar, an amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you tonight. I'm really excited about this because we're going to talk a little bit about some people that made history and were a big influence in rock music. And I want to open real quick with a quick tale. When I first saw the group Fanny, I was at SC, and it was an afternoon. We had like lunchtime concerts. And I'm still trying to figure out, we were talking a little bit before the show, when it actually happened. But I started at SC at around in 1972, so it had to be at least then. But anyway, this group came out, and they just rocked, and it was great. I mean, they were doing a lot of stuff, blues-based type of rock, and it was really, really solid. And I just remember June was playing a Les Paul. I remember the Les Paul. I know that. And I remember the twin reverb amp. And I just like, that's just a killer sound. She had it cranked up, and it was just, it was a great bluesy type of tone. And that was the first time that I had heard about them, and I followed up, and I had known about them for years. And I want to, before I play a clip, I'm going to play a live clip to kind of give you a feel of the energy that they had, because they really rocked, and it was pretty impressive. And this is from her book, Land of a Thousand Bridges, Island Girl in a Rock and Roll World. But it kind of sets the show up, and it also kind of sets up where June is coming from. And I quote, "Tone is a big component of what sets me apart stylistically, since I'm not a gunslinger-type lead player. And some of you out there will know what I mean. Of course, I have a competitive nature. You have to have that to move forward, but there's a certain point over which I cannot and won't cross, and that is trying to outgun other guitar players with blasts of notes. I just can't do it. In the final analysis, I've always felt it demeaning, showing lack of respect for the regard in which I hold the entire venture, which includes the spiritual. I have to feel it, really feel it, or it means nothing. In fact, less than that, I'm bored. Don't do that. Inspiration's what holds me. I am not a samurai guitar player. I will not defend to the death. Ninja, maybe, but definitely not a machine gunner. Don't get me wrong. I like the guys who are and do it well. But there aren't many who do. You'd be surprised how many people play notes but not music. There is a fine line, and that other place, that's where you want to live." That kind of defines the whole thing, and it, to me, was one of the important things I got out of the book. And then I'm going to play a clip real quick, and then we'll get right into the interview. But this is a live clip from 1972, if I'm correct, and this is the title song of their second album, Charity Ball. This is Charity Ball Live.
Thank you.
pure, unabashed rock and roll. I want to welcome June Millington to the show. June, it's truly an honor to have you on the show tonight.
Hi. that was fun hearing my words coming back in your voice. That was really fun. I liked it.
it's true, though. It's really mm-hmm. true. And I yeah. the whole book, it kind of to me was the part of the defining thing for me in terms of the your whole musical journey. And yeah. it's just amazing how much you've influenced and opened the door for so many other artists and stuff. And it's to me fascinating because you were right there with you were in the middle of it. And it was a really interesting time especially in England and in LA. That was yeah. a real creative time. And I'm going to be mentioning this several times throughout the show. This is a must read. It's really, really cool what she's saying in the book. She really goes into detail her whole where she came from and where she went to, so to speak. And one of the things I really liked about the book is she defines like periods of time by the music that she listened to. So it's interesting because it shows you where her influences were and where she was picking up a lot of her ideas. And there was a lot of different stuff. And I thought it was so cool that you guys were really influenced by funk and R&B, because a lot of my favorite players, that was some of their background. And it's obvious the blues influence in your playing. So anyway, real quick, let's just kind of summarize a little bit of how you would define your style in terms of your playing.
Well, it's interesting because actually I don't think of myself as a blues player. I didn't really listen to the blues or play it or want to play it till Lowell George sat me down in '69. Mm-hmm. And, you know, prior to that year, really, I was the rhythm guitar player. And I had to take over the lead guitar player role for kind of band technical reasons. And prior to that, really, we were a funk kind of Motown rock band, because when we started in late 64, 65, 66, and, you know, up to 68, really, we were playing dances. You know, we mm-hmm. weren't playing concerts and going, you know, listen to the song I just wrote kind yeah. of thing. We were a working all-girl band who were just trying to you know, have fun and make enough money to just keep going and see how we could possibly, you know, break into the business. And I mean, and how could you do that when there had been no one before, you know? So that was a complete mystery. But the main thing that I remember was how much fun it was to play at dances. You know, really, if you played Land of a Thousand Dances, which is basically yes. a riff that I took from my book, Land of a Thousand Bridges, when you played that and My Girl and Apples, Peaches, Pumpkin Pie, and you were playing for returning Vietnam vets or guys who were just about to leave for Vietnam, or a high school dance or a frat party where they're just, you know, kind of drinking and going wild, or, you know, at the slopes of Lake Tahoe at night after everyone had been out skiing during the day, you know, and everyone's more or less 17 to 22. Mm-hmm. And it's 1965, 66. You know, that is a whole other scene. And it was really, it was so much fun to do that. And you were playing Beatles and Beach Boys and Motown. And, you know, I was learning the licks on, like, Hold On, I'm Coming, for example. Mm-hmm. Walking the Dog. I mean, to play Walking the Dog is something I recommend to everybody, because it's kind of just basically one chord and one lick, and that lick was, by the way, taken for and slightly amended for Day Tripper. You know, okay. And so it's the stuff that we're thinking of now as classic rock was starting, I think, to be invented around 64, 65. And then you get Hendrix going over to England, and you have the English guys coming over here, and it's a whole melding. But honestly, I never heard the blues in the Philippines. I didn't know it even existed. You know, when we started playing acoustic and ukulele. So 65 to 69 was for me the defining point at which I started to understand how you could make sense out of different types of guitar parts. I mean, you can't just slap the pentatonic over everything, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. And I was a huge fan of a lot of different things, like Moving On by Stevie Wonder. I mean, that was the first hit that he had that I know of or that I heard. Where after his voice dropped, and I really noticed that song, and I was like, what is going on here? That was the same year I first heard The Grateful Dead, and that was because I was going to UC Davis. You know, I was mm-hmm. actually a pre-med student. So I'm listening to Dusty Springfield and Stevie Wonder singing country. He's trying to figure out how he's going to stay in the biz with his voice dropping, and you've got the Beatles, the Beach Boys, as I mentioned, the English sounds. So, you know, and then I hear the Grateful Dead, and then I see the original Buffalo Springfield. I mean, it was really a mind blower. And believe me, when I say gunslingers, I'm talking about there were gunslingers in Sacramento. Mm-hmm. I'm not even talking going into Oakland and San Francisco, which I did later. You know, we were just young lasses. I've never even taken a puff yet, you know. Mm-hmm. I didn't know there were drugs. I just wanted to, you know, I mean, when you were pumping it on stage and you were singing Come See About Me, which I can do with my eyes closed, or Heat Wave on acoustic guitars even, it's really amazing stuff. They have got those grooves down, you know, and those grooves will never stop. And that's what I love, really. And, you know, even Jimi Hendrix said it. He really loved playing rhythm more than he did lead guitar. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, when he was playing lead guitar, I'm sure he wasn't thinking, oh, I wish I were playing rhythm. But, you know, that feeling of a groove where, and I say it in the book, where you're safe. In those periods of 3 to 5 minutes in which we were grooving and we were pleasing people and we were all dancing together. I mean, we were on stage, but everyone in the audience was dancing. Those were the times when I felt safe. And that's part of the reason why music means so much to me, because being bicultural and biracial and a woman and coming over from the Philippines when we were 13, not having friends, and it just kind of goes on and on. Let's don't even talk about sexism yet. I mean, that's racism, right? For me, comes way before sexism. So, you know, in fact, I was well armed for that, because I had already kind of cauterized myself from, like, you know, it really actually doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. You know, I couldn't feel any worse in terms of feeling isolated. So let's go for it. Let's have fun.
Right. Well, did you find that when you were playing the clubs that the other groups were threatened by you, or did they see it? Sounded because what it sounded to me was when you were playing, you were all friends, so it seemed like it was kind of a cool
well
thing.
We were friends, and then there would be boyfriends, girlfriends, and there, yeah. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on, because, you know, you're teenagers, and you know, there's drama and there's everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't admit it to us then, but they're admitting it to me now, those who have kept up and uh-huh. stayed friends. You know, they're like, holy shit, man, we just used to watch you guys and go, whoa. And we left them in the dust, really. And part of it really was the war, because so many of them got drafted, you know, or yeah. had to figure out ways where they wouldn't. And some did go. I mean, and that's in the book, too. You know, some of our friends from high school did have to go to Vietnam or Germany or be a, you know, support troops somewhere. Mm-hmm. And we got to just kept boogalooing down Broadway. You know, we got to do that. Mm-hmm. And keep learning the changing styles of music. You know, I mean, you got the Grateful Dead, and you got Come On, People Now, Smile on Your Brother. Yes. I mean, you know, that's a lot of kind of diversity.
Right.
And but it was something that we breathed in every day. We ate it in every day. We kept playing. I mean, even when our high school drummer Bree, who was before Alice, who was on most of the records, Bree's mm-hmm. on the last album that I wasn't on. Even when she got pregnant, well, I mean, at some point she just kept playing with us, and she just pushed the drum stool back.
Mm-hmm.
But she didn't have to go to basic camp, you know?
Yeah,
I mean, that's
yeah.
really, that's a big difference, because we didn't have to be taken away from what was our chosen job, which was to go out there and funk it, seriously.
Yeah. Well, yeah. The a lot of people that have never, you know, if you've lived in the 60s, that was a magical time because there was a merging of styles and everybody was into everything. And then they would just kind of make it their own. And it's hard for people that were born later. I know it's because they don't understand it because everything kind of was, you know, by the late 70s and 80s, everything's categorized. So it's kind of, well, it's that, it's this. But back then it was new.
It wasn't just emerging. It was inventing.
Right. And I mean, you were right in the middle of it.
I might have said it, what you just alluded to, but I cannot emphasize how much the invention of sounds was adding to the music. I mean, you were asking me earlier about my sounds and different studios and different guitars and whatnot. I mean, amps and tubes and, you know, and the guys I was running into in Sacramento and then the Bay Area and then L.A. When I got to get to know people better, like Skunk Baxter and Lowell George and Elliot Randall, who was in and out of town, and later on John Hall and whatnot. I mean, you know, these are guys who spent all their time figuring out how to get the best sounds out of the tubes and out of the strings and, mm-hmm. you know, and Ry Cooder was on the same label. You know, we were on Reprise and I would run into him in the halls of recording studio. We didn't really talk too much, but, you know, it was like there was a recognition. Oh, yeah, you're working really hard and I'm working really hard, too. And there was just that sort of, that respect. And I really appreciated that from the guys who I knew were good because mm-hmm. they didn't. You know, they didn't try to chat too much with me about, oh, I don't know, just little things. You know, we were all really looking for the perfect sound. I mean, right. full time. And that is something I don't see actually that much today. You know, that's why I kind of focused in on tone, because if you're working on tone, you can really get whatever you're learning slowly but surely. Although, you know, now people are going to Berkeley or whatnot, you know, GIT, and they're learning a lot of licks and they're learning a lot of arpeggios. I didn't have that luxury. Mm-hmm. I never even really took a guitar lesson because my dad, you know, he couldn't afford it. He was changing jobs when we moved. He was changing professions, working during the day, going to school at night, supporting seven kids. So I couldn't take a lesson. So really what I did was I learned from others, and we learned on the job. There was nothing like, you know, learning, do you believe in magic? Hearing it on Sunday, do you believe in magic? Starting to learn it on Monday and playing it on Saturday at an Air Force base, and everyone just like losing it because it made mm-hmm. them so happy, you know? That is a type of sort of boots on the ground education that is, I mean, you just, you know, you can't buy that. You can't
right,
buy that.
Right. No, playing in the trenches. There's just something about it. It's a unique thing.
Well, and
thing.
The immediacy and all the great music and songs that were coming out between, say, 65 and 75 and, of course, beyond. But that was a really, you know, fertile time in American music. Mm-hmm. And American music is something I have seen in the book is something that I've studied very carefully. Once I realized, oh, this is going to be my job, rather than being a surgeon and learning the, you know, the chemical table or something. Yeah. This is my job. This is what I'm going to do. And I know how to study, you know, because I was raised in the Philippines where, you know, it's like a very kind of strict education. They know how to work. And so I knew how to study, and we got good grades, but we also were learning how to rock and funk it at the same time. Mm-hmm. So it was really incredible, the fact that we'd had that kind of discipline sort of drummed into us.
Well, how did it change when you moved to L.A. in terms of, I know you were going to the clubs and checking out the scene. Was it uh-huh. any, it must have been a lot different than from up north, because it wasn't as, you were seeing more, it changed, it wasn't as dance oriented, right? Because you were going to the Whiskey and stuff. I don't know if that was a club that you would call a dance club at that time. You were
singing. Oh, yeah.
Oh, really? No,
people were boogling all over the place. I'll tell you the biggest difference. Up north in San Francisco, it was still very much the flower power thing, you know? Mm-hmm. So you got the outfits, you got the sound, you got the smells, you know, the incense and patchouli and all that. Maybe it was really its own thing, and people are right to reminisce about it because it was just like you were walking on a cloud. Mm-hmm. L.A. is business, you know? Mm-hmm. L.A. is business. And so yeah, maybe we would drive from, you know, from the Strip and go down to Hermosa Beach or something to go see a band. And as a matter of fact, we became good friends. I felt good friends with the band Bertha until we all started to go on the road. And we used to go watch them at clubs and so forth. But if you would read somebody like, you know, Frank Zappa's comments about the difference between L.A. music and San Francisco, it's pretty funny. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. You know, real men don't play. I mean, I'm just making that up. But
right.
If I were to make up some sort of a slogan that would capsulize sort of what Frank mm-hmm. had to say. And by the way, we met him almost right away when we got to L.A. Just a great guy. You know, real men don't wear with flowers around their necks or something like that. You know, smelling like girls.
Yeah. Well, did you prefer live over the studio, or did you like doing studio work? Because I know you had done the session for Streisand, and yeah. that was beautiful. The guitar.
Well,
work.
But I mean, yes.
Were you more into that, or
I loved it all. I really did. But you know, you can't get to a session with Streisand, or you can't get to a backing session for anybody, really, unless you know how to stick to the chart and the groove. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, like I said, LA is business. So when you walk into the studio and they put the chart in front of you, first of all, you better have a few sounds at your fingertips with your guitar or guitars and your amp. Like, you got your rig, right? But you got to do it, man. You got to do it. In order to do it, having that experience in the clubs and whatnot is gold. It's golden, mm-hmm. you know? Because you're expected to reproduce that, you know. Why else would somebody buy the record unless they can do that same thing over and over again? It's what people love. They love to sing along with the records and dance. I mean, come on, it's our bliss.
Okay, well, you were called into the session to sound like you, as opposed to some of the session musicians like the Wrecking Crew, where you're basically made, you had to sound like anybody.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, if they wanted the Wrecking Crew, they could have gotten it. But, you know, Barbara came to our gigs, so she very well knew what our sound was, and mm-hmm. she liked it. She yeah. liked it. And of course, Richard was producing us, and he was producing her.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, and that era, really, when you're talking about the early 70s, was a time of experimentation. I mean, the two groups that Richard had produced right before us, and one was a hit, that was Tiptoe Through the Tulips. The people forget that he was producing Captain Beefheart.
Oh, wow.
Produced Captain Beefheart right before he produced Fanny, you know? So, I mean, come on, you know, that's a real, I mean, there was something that Richard understood about the gamut of sounds and about, you know, let's say the almost vaudeville aspect, and that's really how the Beatles got their contract. You know, they mm-hmm. were seen as a novelty act, really. No one would sign them, you know. And Fanny was seen as a novelty act in terms of being signed, but Richard knew something. You know, he knew something about mm-hmm. the arc of music, and he's really musically intelligent.
Mm-hmm. Now, how much... When you were working with Richard on the first, you actually did three albums with him. How much was it? Was he more of like a director, or did you have a lot of say in what was going on in terms of the guitar sound, how you the guitar parts, your arrangements, or was?
Well, the part that you're not able to actually allude to now is the part of where we worked in the basement of Fanny Hill together.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Or where we would go up to his house and just listen to records or listen to work in progress, mm-hmm. you know. So there was a lot of stuff that went on not in the studio that informed how well and how quickly we worked in the studio. And another component is that Richard was getting his chops super together as a producer, and because we were with Reprise, which became Warner Brothers, and our managers and Richard were tied with Mo Austin and all the guys at Warner mm-hmm. Brothers, mm-hmm. you know, it was like a club, and you know, but it was professional, and they didn't go golfing that I know of, but you know, there was a lot of clubbing, and you know, when he would come down to the basement and we would play for him, we would discuss what were the sounds that were happening. And of course, at the same time, we were jamming with Little Feet and who knows what, you know, whom, coming to the basement. So we were always morphing our sounds. And, you know, so working with him in terms of understanding how he approached even songwriting was really instructive and helped us all gel so that by the time we got into the studio, we had another way of talking. I mean, I even could tell from the way that Richard stuttered how he felt, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, seriously. So we were that close, and I never, you know, it was never a judgment for me in terms of, you know, how he conducted himself, except for when he tried to turn my guitar down, my amp down without asking me. And then we got in huge fights, and that's in the book too. But, you know, he's so musically intelligent. And the other thing that he did while getting his chops together, and I'm sure, you know, it was put on our bill, but we would go to different studios in L.A. and we would record demos, essentially, and we would try girls out for that mysterious fourth member we needed. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we flew them in from other places. So he was getting to try out different studios, different engineers, and different sounds, and we were getting to learn how to record. So that's when we really started to understand mic placement or volume, tone, and especially, and I have to emphasize this, singing around one mic.
Oh,
so
wow. Okay.
A lot of time was spent carefully positioning ourselves around the mic. We'd sing with the track or a cappella, and then he'd move someone slightly in or out. So we understood how it was that you need to work with an engineer to get your good sound. You know, mm-hmm, it doesn't just like kind of happen. You have to be patient and you have to pace yourself.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when it gets hot, hopefully it gets hot around the same time that they're getting the right sound, they have the right mic up, and you know, so it's a lot of it's super timing.
Yeah, no, I hear you. When you play, now let me talk a little, let's get a little bit into your tone.
Yeah.
When you played distorted, you always cranked the amp, or did you ever use like a fuzz or a distortion pedal, or did you ever?
I think I tried to use fuzz. I forget who made it now. Somebody who's like famous now, but. And I used it on the road. I don't know how much I used it in the studio, but on the road it would pick up like police scanners and taxi scanners, you know, so it was kind of a drag. But no, typically I fussed with my amp a lot. And I also did that between songs on stage with Fanny, especially with the twin, you know, because it's all about tone. But where you've got gain and a master, gosh, did we even have a master volume, then that would have to be put in, you know, especially. So everyone was totally always fooling. The amps were always changing. I heard about that new guy, man, in the valley, and he's got like some new thing that he can put in. Then there we would all go and try to get that, you know. So it wasn't at all like today where you have, I mean, not just hundreds, you got thousands of sounds to choose of. And actually, I'm so sick of it that I don't even use pedals anymore. I have one amp. I choose my guitar. I like that amp to have, you know, clean crunch and overdrive, and that is it. I mean, I have got to make do with that. I mean, if it doesn't happen, I'm just not going to do it. You know, I'm not into it anymore. It's just so much time, and you got to take care of them, and your batteries, and I don't know what. You got to chain them together. Then you got to choose if the loop pedal or the loop reverb or echo, and is it going to be 100 milliseconds or it just goes on and on, chorusing, flanging. I mean, come on. I'm sick of it. I'm 67. I just want to get that sound and
you
play.
Just want to
get
you.
Have some fun, you know?
No, I hear you. I hear you.
A bunch of stuff.
Now, let me ask you this, though. Do you still have your twin?
I don't.
Ah, it sounded great. No, because you had JBLs in there, too.
I don't remember, you know, what happened to that amp, but it sort of doesn't matter because I've gone back to Fender. And I've got a DeVille, you know, with 412s.
Oh, okay, so you're
got basically what I need. I mean, I threw a challenge down to Fender once, and I said, you know, I need an amp that'll give me, like, blah, blah, blah. And they sent me a couple, and I settled down with the DeVille.
So you're still tubes, definitely.
Oh, what else is there? I mean,
okay,
what?
Okay, okay.
You're not going to
Your sound is tube, I know. It's. Now do you still have your 355?
I don't. I felt like I had to sell it because I never really made that much money, so I was constantly kind of shifting everything around, and I guess I felt like I had to sell. But I did sell it to our one of our main tech guys who had been Nikki's Nikki's first husband or boyfriend, whatever it was. Mm-hmm. I think it was a husband when we first met her, and he's a really nice guy. So he's the one who stripped my Strat for me.
Oh, okay. Because that was that 355 was that's a beautiful guitar. The pictures in your book.
But you know, actually, it was kind of. I mean, I wish I still had it, but it was kind of overkill because it's a stereo. So, you know, I'm deaf in one ear, and most people don't really take that seriously. But I really am deaf in my left ear, and I've never heard in it that I can remember. And I didn't know I was deaf in my left ear until I was 13, and we moved to Sacramento. So, you know, I tried to use it in the stereo mode. I had two amps on either side of the stage, and they had to make me these special cables. And I mean, on and on and on. Again, we get with that whole tech fussing over everything, you know. And, you know, at some point I realized, it's just, it's too much. And let's just get that sound and that amp or those couple of amps. And also, you know, by the time we got to Apple, I also had the Les Paul, whom I'm going to say whom because I feel like that Les Paul is a person. It's right in the room here with me. Well, has a certain sound and a certain personality. And I was so shy with that guitar. I didn't even want it. It took me a year to start playing it.
Well, speaking of the Les Paul, I had a request from Joe Bonamassa. He wanted to have me ask you about the story about that guitar because Skunk worked on that, right? Skunk Baxter had
modded. He did. He put the master volume in. He talked me into it. I wasn't so interested even in that. So everything about that Les Paul is just a complete fluke.
So he just put a master volume on it, or did he do anything else to it? Did he alter it?
No, he did a lot of tweaking. Jeff's always tweaking. But the story around that Les Paul is that I was in New York and Fanny was on the road and I got a phone call. He got my number, Kent Henry, because he's a friend of mine, and he was in the band Blues Image, and he was also the replacement guitar player in Steppenwolf. And I adored him. And he called me out of the blue and asked me as a favor to buy that Les Paul from him. And I'm like, I think I was just waking up or something. I'm like, well, I'll ask our accountant. And if he says yes, okay, I'll get it from you. I'll buy it from you. Oh, God. So he asked me to pay $500, and I got the message, you know, from our road manager that it was an okay. So when we got back from that tour, there was that Les Paul in its case sitting on the sandstone floor at Fanny Hill, which is Hedy Lamarr's ex-house. A lot of energy in that house. And I really don't think I even opened it for maybe even a month. Wow. And I'm quite sure I didn't really, really play it for like something like a year or something like that. But slowly, you know, because it's such a different, you know, it's a piece of wood, whereas the 355 is a semi-hollow body. So that's going to scream a little bit differently. You know, with a Les Paul, even though this one's so special, you got to give it a certain kind of air from other places, like the tubes or whatever.
Right.
The 355 is going to scream and moan and kind of cry like a baby. Just because of those holes, you know, it's very kind of, you know, quirky and sensitive, and you got to know that guitar. Well, so, and also I would always have problems with the intonation. Man, that guitar was really difficult to keep in tune. And I had my guitar guys and everyone was always trying to figure out a way to, you know, to get the intonation right. I was always tuning between takes in the studio. And I can't say that the Les Paul is 1,000% better than that, but it held better.
What year was the 355? Do you know?
Oh, boy. You know, I don't remember. I'm sure somebody could look it up. Somebody out there, please, right now.
Well, June Millington's. Since you have the Les Paul there, can you just play a little bit of it and show us a little bit of the guitar? Do you have it there?
Yeah, I got it right here. Let me see. Do I have the amp on? I think I do. All right. Well, I think I have it on a sweet tone right now, so let's see.
It's nice. And that's you're using the Fender amp,
I've got a Fender amp in here. I'm not in the big room, you know. And that was just with my fingers, you know. So, you know, it's just got this thing, you know. I it's just got a sweetness to it. And if you want a little, you know, if you want a, let me see, what amp am I in? A little growl. And this is a lick I made up, I think, on this guitar. It's to a song called Running, which just I just re-released because John Cuniberti, the great engineer-producer who engineered it, said, hey, man, why don't I just remaster it and you put it out because I love this record. So I found the master mix, you know. So so here's this lick for Running. Let me see. Let me turn it up. There we go. So, you know, it's got a whole... And that's not my main tone. That's just a small Fender I got here. But it gives you an idea.
Mm-hmm. No, it's a great sound guitar.
It plays itself. Come on, seriously. You only need to know about five or six licks, and then you just, whoa, take off.
That's okay. Just my friends know me by my middle name. Never sell. Never. Please do not sell that guitar. It's so part of you. It's like, no, you can't. You can't. It would be a tragedy.
No, that would be impossible at this point. It's just not going to happen.
Now, you had another guitar, a double cutaway. I think it was a Les Paul with the P90 pickups on that. I see that a lot in the pictures.
Oh, you mean the yellow one or the chartreuse one? Yeah.
That's a Les Paul, right?
Yeah, it's the Junior.
The Junior. You still have...
I'm told it's a TV special.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
There's, yeah. But do you still have that one?
Oh, yeah. I got it right here. I mean, I actually brought all my friends into the room to keep me company for this.
And then later on, you started using the Strat, right? You bought that Strat later.
No, I bought the Strat, I think, on our very first national tour.
Oh, okay.
Bought it from a kid in Memphis. But again, you know, sometimes my guitar is just kind of, you know, I'm very shy. And I have to develop a relationship, you know. So what happened with the Strat was it had seven layers of house paint on it, and I bought it from a kid in Memphis who lived in a trailer with his mom. I felt kind of bad about that, but he did put an ad in the paper, and I guess they needed the money. Mm-hmm. And it kind of looked like crap, but I mean, you know, it was a Strat, and I think it was like $125, so I could do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And took it back to L.A., and the guy Alan, who bought the 355 from me, stripped it down for me. Because I had this idea, I forget how I got it, but I just had this idea. I wanted a guitar to be just down to its natural wood. And so he did take it down to natural wood. He sanded it and he put this varnish on it. And I love it. And it has a really special sound. And so that one I used actually 72, 73, and it's on the Todd Rundgren album that we did in New York, the album that Todd produced. In fact, he wanted to buy that guitar for me, and I just like, what? I don't sell my friends. Like, yeah, I mean, he fell in love with the sound, and it really is special. And then sometime in the early 80s, I think it was, I wrote a song, and I needed it to be down a step.
Mm-hmm.
So I had that guitar. I had the... I have really heavy strings on it, and it has a block. What do you call that on the other side?
The tremolo, there's a block, but it's probably...
Well, the tremolo's out. It's not there anymore. And so where the, you know, where whatever the mechanism is that allowed you to bend the neck and back, it's got a block there so that it holds the tuning better a step down.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I only use gold-plated strings, and the way that happened was... My then brother-in-law, Earl Slick, had gotten off the road with David Bowie. And, of course, people were throwing, you know, Sirius Moonlight. They were throwing all sorts of stuff at him. And I visited him and Gene once and the kids. And he had these strings. He said, you want these strings? They're not really doing anything for me. And I couldn't believe it. I mean, the harmonics that happened. I was doing a lot of solo gigs then. And... So I'm just, you know, that's what I use. Is I use gold plated strings, and they're kind of hard to find now, but they're amazing.
No.
I've heard other people. No one's going to be able to follow up on because you can't go into Guitar Center or whatever. And I've tried, believe me, and you can't get them.
Well, I'm going to play a clip right now. This is Ain't That Peculiar, and it shows your slide playing. I want to talk a little bit about your slide playing. So let me play the clip real quick because it's a beautiful, what you do is just 100% taste. Here it goes. Now, that was from the Fannie Hill album from 72, and that was at Apple Studios. And we haven't had time to play all the different clips from the different albums, but you can hear that sound is very distinctive from that
album. Nice editing, by the way.
But now, how did you get into slide guitar? What made you go in that direction? Because you do it great. And who were your influences?
I think it was because I was hanging out with Joel Tepp, who's a great slide guitar player, and Lowell, of course. I can't remember whom I met first, but they taught me a lot. I mean, they would sit me down and say, June, this is what you got to listen to. This is how you play it. This is how you control one note. This is how you slide up, slide down, you know, open tuning. I mean, Bonnie, you know. So they were my main influences, and just how they, you know, I mean, they really concentrate on slide. I feel like I'm kind of a dilettante, to tell you the truth, on slide, you know.
No, you got the tone. Now, that was that your Les Paul with the twin, or was that?
I'm pretty sure that's the 355, because it has kind of a broader, it has that sound that I was talking about earlier, where it's just about to start screaming at you, you know. It's like, and it has that, from the jump, you know, from the very first lick. Now, I did hear that double guitar sound. It's kind of that Beatles George Harrison sound. Yeah. So I'm pretty sure that would have been the 355 doubled with a Les Paul, which I had them both at Apple.
Yeah,
and you know, quite frankly, I mean, the great thing about Jeff Emmerich is that nothing scared him. I mean, he was like, you know, bring it on. Slap a mic on it. I know my mics. I know my room, you know. So we just got down to work, and he loves the memories of working with us. And everyone, all the Brits, were completely stoked once they learned we could play. I mean, the first day we came in, you know, they brought us to Apple, and Harry Nilsson, you know, had to join us.
Yeah, but I mean, the sound you're getting from your guitar and the taste of the, and especially in that song, any engineer would have a blast, because it's like it plays itself, so to speak.
Yeah.
But
you really did get a
great sound in there, and you can that whole album, the guitar tones that you're getting from that are just amazing.
Well, and it was my sound. I wasn't trying to copy anyone at that point. You know, it's like I had developed my sound, and you know, we were on the road all the time, so I actually didn't get to jam that much with my best friends anymore. Mm-hmm. I was on my own, you know, so there was a lot of jamming for about a year and a half, and learning all that about tone and whatnot. And you know, when Little Feet first went out, they went on their first tour, and then they came back, and they had stories about jamming with, you know, the Stones and whatnot. I just wish I would have had more time to play with everyone, but no one really had that much time anymore. We were just on the road. And so, you know, we had to just do it. I mean, it was like either you had gotten enough under your belt or you're finished.
Right. So the London scene was very much would you say it was much like the LA scene? It was business. You had to get in there and get out, get the work done? Or
no.
Was it different?
I mean, yes, it was business, but London is, it doesn't feel like, you know, to me, LA was Sunset Strip, you know, and Santa Monica Boulevard, the Troubadour, you know, like just like five clubs. So it felt smaller, but it felt incredibly concentrated, you mm-hmm. know, and the record company heads were there and the record companies and studios. But for some reason, London felt wider. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, maybe there's more drinking going on or something. I don't know. I don't really drink, but there was a looser feeling. I don't want mm-hmm. to really say drinking. That was the wrong word. But, you know, those Brits, they're pretty relaxed in their own way. Like, they'll take those tea breaks, and then everyone goes to the pub afterwards. I mean, I don't know how they do it, you know? I didn't drink tea back then. Yeah. I didn't know about coffee. It was Paul Buckmaster who turned me on to coffee. I mean, really, I'm kind of a straight nerd because of the fact that I don't have equilibrium or hearing on one side. I have to mm-hmm. really watch it. And fortunately, I didn't learn all that till I was like in my teens and 20s, how much I had to take care of my body. So I just kind of plunged ahead with everybody else. And I lived. I mean, that's the really cool thing. I lived.
Yeah, no, you for hearing in mono, you did a damn good job in stereo. Let me put it that way.
Hey, but wait a minute, you know Brian Wilson? Come on, you know. So well, me and Brian Wilson, that's it. Baby.
No, you're in good company. Another person that had lost hearing in his ear from birth was Johnny Ray. I don't know if you knew that.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I tried to.
I like it.
And I tried to explain surround sound to him, and it was.
It's all a concept, you know, and you can get the conceptual thing, but you know, really, you really hear tuning and intonation mm-hmm. super well. And then, for me, I know in particular, I hear like things that sounds and I don't know voices that other people don't hear, and they don't scare me. I mean, they give me my songs and my licks. I mean, one time at camp, I remember some girls were working on a song in our garage. We actually have a garage band set up, and they were asking me to help them. And I said, okay. So I, you know, listened to them. I played a little bit with them. Then I said, give me a minute. So I went back, actually inside this room, the studio, and I closed the doors. And I just kind of sat and let sounds come into me. And I went out 5 minutes later and said, okay. And I just played them some stuff, which they loved. They said, well, how did you do that? And I said, well, I just got silent and I listened. You know, and it seemed like a huge, I don't know, like mystery or incredible. What inspiration. And actually, you know, I'm just a channel. And I think that being deaf in one ear, you know, hear people say, well, there's always a reason for everything. I really feel like that's the reason I came in like that. And it saved my life with the equilibrium because I couldn't get over, you know, I couldn't drink and I couldn't do too many drugs because then I would just keel over, mm-hmm. you know. So I have to really watch it. And that makes for a really interesting musical life.
Well, I told you it'd go by fast. We're almost out of time, but I want to talk briefly about the school that you have set up, the Institute of Musical Arts.
Yeah.
It's basic. Is it a school curriculum or is it just like a little camps or groups of like, is it like a full semester or is it smaller?
Well, the way you've described it is sort of the bookends of how we try to approach it. I mean, this is an institute that was founded in really 86, 87. We got mm-hmm. our 501c3 in 87. And, you know, at first I thought, or myself and Anne, my partner, who is the executive director and a co-founder, there were five of us, we thought that it would be a school, you know, but then to get accredited and then all that stuff, it sort of felt like it would just take us off the path that we really wanted to do, which we were just kind of feeling, intuiting, mm-hmm. which is, and it says in our bylaws, to help women and girls in music and music-related business. Well, that is whatever you want to make of it, you know, really. It's a huge, broad mission statement. And how it worked out was we just started really slowly. We got a few grants. We got a space in Bodega, California, in what's called the old Creamery. It was an artist colony. We just started to do shows and workshops and whatnot. And then finally we were able to buy this land here in Massachusetts, and it's everything here is getting passed on to future generations, so it's powerful. And so these, you know, these little camps are not little. They're little in number. They're 14. We keep it to 14 students max. Sometimes we go to 15, but that's actually 15, 16 is too big. And we have three instructors per camp, and they're really intense, you know, and they're changing lives, and we're building a new sisterhood. So it's powerful. It's an important piece of society that's emerging, you know, especially with women and girls realizing that they have a job to do in this world, and we need to get it together. You know, I mean, I think everybody's starting to really realize that we need to get it together. And part of it is women and girls, you know, that we emerge, and music is a second language. It is a language. And here we are in what I call the magical queendom.
Well, to be honest with you, doing this show now, I'm seeing the different guests that I'm having on. I'm seeing 50-50 girls and guys. I mean, I'm not seeing a dominance anymore. And out here, I'm meeting a lot of musicians, women musicians that are just killer
yes.
musicians.
That's right, and
it's great. I think it's. Yeah. I mean, it's like anything. Music should know no gender, no race, no creed, no color. It's music, and to me, that's what the most important thing is. And I think that I'm seeing some powerful musicians and artists that are coming out. And what you're doing is just amazing. I think that that's very important, and it's really critical that we. I mean, it's something that is definitely a positive thing. We're out of time, and I just want to throw in real quick, everybody, if you can get this book, Land of a Thousand Bridges, Island Girl in a Rock and Roll World, you can get it at, if you go on www.junemillington.com or www.ima.org, which is their Institute of Musical Arts site, you can order the book from there, and I recommend it.
And all the profits go to IMA, by the way.
So yes.
You're playing it forward, we're investing in ourselves, in our future.
Right. And I want to thank Ann Hackler, your partner, for helping me, and also Jim Crockett, who's introduced me to you. So, because I was actually looking for you for a long time. I didn't know where I finally Googled and found out what was happening, but. You know, I heard about Fanny, but like, well, what's she doing now?
It's so much easier to find me now that the internet is happening.
Yeah, well, now with Facebook, no, it's great. Yeah. But now we definitely have to have you back. I just touched the surface of what musically what you're about, and I really appreciate you coming on because it's late over there and having all the guitars and stuff because they're just we didn't even get a chance to go through some of the other ones. But I want to leave everybody with this quote from David Bowie in Rolling Stone magazine. In 1999, this is after Fanny had broken up, and I think it's important. And I'm going to leave you with a song that shows the acoustic guitar work that, and again, it's just 100% taste of what June Millington's playing is about. And let me say the quote first, and we'll play the clip. One of the most important female bands in American rock has been buried without a trace, and that is Fanny. They were one of the finest rock bands of their time in about 1973. They were extraordinary. They're as important as anybody else who's ever been, ever. It just wasn't their time. Revivify Fanny, and I will feel that my work is done. That's from David Bowie. That's something that,
Thank you. No,
it's true. You opened the door with people like Joni Mitchell and Laura Nero, especially Laura Nero. You opened the door to start all of the different, you know, all the groups that came out, and that's important. And also, too, being in with the people that you were in that whole creative era, you were part of it. You formed what we listen to now. I mean, I feel it. So. Anyway, I want to thank you again, and we'll definitely have you back on. Hang on until after the song is over, and I just want to talk to you off the air. This song is called Tomorrow, and it's from the Fanny Hill, the one that was done with Jeff Emmerich in London on Apple.
Actually, it wasn't on that. It was it's a bonus track on the collection.
Oh, I'm sorry.
In fact, when I heard it, I didn't know who it was. I called Gene and Alice, and I said, "Who is that?" And they said, "Well, it's got to be you."
Well, it's tasty. No, it sounds like stylistically, it does kind of from listening of all the stuff on the anthology, it does sound like you. But it was that done in London then? where you don't remember.
Yes, yeah. And there are photos in the book that show me with a guitar, with that my J50.
Oh, okay. All right, hold. Let me play that. Everybody have a great week. We'll see you next week. And hang on, June. I'll talk to you after this song is done. This is Tomorrow.
Freaks and dancers.